many times and a couple times here, that if I ever have the opportunity to teach a course at our theological seminary in the archaeology of Palestine, Syria, Palestine, I would attempt to call it archaeology in the Bible, proof or improvement. If I were to teach the same course in the second university, I often think I would call it the meaning of things. And so the introduction to archaeology would be meaning of things one, and the advanced course, meaning of things two, and so forth. Working as I do in a theological seminary, and having responsibility for dealing with biblical material, the meaning of things as it is taught in the secular university is very, very helpful to me and to us in clarifying our understanding of the meanings of ancient texts. And in dealing with ancient texts, there is another kind of archaeology that we have to do, because very often the texts themselves are stratified. The stories, the books, have been put through more than one, and sometimes several major editions, editings, revisings, out of a long and complicated process before they reach the attained form in which they have come down to us. And I think it will be helpful this evening, or appropriate, given the stories that I want to deal with, namely the stories in Joshua 7 and 8, to approach them from the other angle and do the literary archaeology, literary stratigraphy first, before looking at the results of the dirt archaeology and the stratigraphy of the tells involved. So first, a bit of literary archaeology. The stories we're concerned with tonight, chapter 7 and 8 of the book of Joshua, recount directly on the heels of that very puzzling but interesting story of the fall of Jericho in Joshua 6, take two whole chapters, by which time we are one third of the way through the book, two chapters to describe, after the first success, they describe the first defeat, that's chapter 7, and in chapter 8, the second victory. The first defeat and the second victory both take place at a town called Ha'ai in Hebrew, which means literally the ruin. So two whole chapters are taken up with first a defeat and then a victory at a place which is already called the ruin long before the allegedly victorious Israelites arrived on the scene. This raises some interesting questions about the kinds of historical claims that are being made in the book and in the story. I'm going to take up a few minutes then to talk about the development of these two books, Joshua and Judges. Can you see what I've printed on the board here? Or should we turn on the other overhead light for a minute?
It is difficult to see.
Okay. Sheree, would you turn on the other overhead light? Right? Your left hand. Thank you. That's better. Books of Joshua and Judges are part of one long historical work, which runs all the way through 2 Kings in the Old Testament. It's the story of ancient Israel's life in the land from the time of Joshua to the final destruction of Jerusalem in 587 by the Babylonian armies. And this work is characterized now almost universally by critical scholars as a Deuteronomic history. That is to say, it is a historical work which is written from a particular point of view that was strong, prominent in ancient Israel, well along in the period of the monarchy. It's a point of view that is expressed by the biblical book called Deuteronomy, which is presented to us as a series of addresses by Moses before his death. And the theology of Deuteronomy goes something like this. As long as Israel is faithful to Yahweh and faithful to the terms of the covenant by which Yahweh has constituted Israel, Israel will continue to live and thrive and prosper in the land that is Yahweh's gift. But if Israel violates the stipulations of covenant relationship, Israel will be expelled from the land. And so the entire history that unfolds in the books of Joshua through 2 Kings unfolds from that perspective. And furthermore, we can say that this large historical work, long historical work, went through at least two major editions. The first one and others nicknamed DTR1. That is the first and major edition of this long historical work, which took shape almost certainly in the reign of a powerful king of Jerusalem, King Josiah, whose dates are there on the board, roughly 640 to 609, well along in the period of the monarchy. It was a period in which Assyrian power, which the Assyrian Empire had dominated the international scene, but Assyrian power was in decline and the time was ripe for a vigorous king in Jerusalem to attempt to assert national independence once again, to reclaim much of territory, especially in the north, that had been lost to the Assyrians a century earlier, and possibly to campaign here in Transjordan, although there is no clear evidence that he did so. In any case, he was a vigorous reforming, nation rebuilding, religion reforming king. And this long historical work reads as though it comes to a climax with the account of his reign in 2 Kings 22 and 23. So it's it is a very, very nationalistic story that unfolded in the first edition of this work. Within 25 years, however, less than 25 years of Josiah's death in 609, a new power had emerged on the international scene, and that was Babylonia. And by 587 BC, Jerusalem had been invaded at least twice, if not three times. The city was destroyed, the temple was destroyed. The leading segments, at least, of the population were deported to Babylonia and to various other parts of the Babylonian Empire, and the period known as the Babylonian Exile begins. At that point, DTR1, which was designed to be supportive of national existence under a vigorously reforming king, DTR1 suddenly became irrelevant for people whose nation had been destroyed. The interesting thing to me is that they didn't jettison that that very nationalistic first edition. But some other people came along and put it through a final edition because it now had to be adapted to be somehow supportive of life in exile, life without nationhood. And so the final editing of this work took place somewhere in the neighborhood of 587 BC, either with that event clearly in view or not long in the wake of the destruction of Jerusalem. So, and one of the things that these final editors did was to provide the entire period of Joshua and Judges, for example, Judges especially, to set it within a tragicomic framework so that we exiles were supposed to be remembering our past, but to be remembering it precisely as past. And I think it's very much an open question whether the final editors of this historical work were in any sense looking forward to a reconstitution of the nation. But that's, as I say, that's very much an open question. Is it clear? In the books of Joshua and Judges, we have very clear evidence of this literary stratification. In the stories of Joshua, the book of Joshua, which recounts how Israel came into possession of the land, stories are told in a highly stylized way, in such a manner clearly as to present Joshua as a model, as an exemplary field commander, and therefore, in other words, to present Joshua, the picture of Joshua, as something of a of an ideal in matters military for the Jerusalem king. And so the stories, the old stories, which had been generated out of the experience, very close to events in the pre-monarchic times, came to be retold in such a way as to present the model for the Jerusalem king. And there are many kinds of anachronisms in the stories in Joshua, because the organization of Israel in the pre-monarchic period often looks as though it has the proportions and the dimensions of the later monarchic nation state. In the book of Judges, on the other hand, the people who put this material together did not rewrite the old stories. The stories in the book of Judges are most unexemplary. The performance of Joshua, or the performance of the Israelites in the land, is shown warts and all. In other words, in the period following Joshua, they let the old stories stand because they were interested in legitimating the transition to a monarchical nation state, which came with in the late 11th and 10th century with Solomon, David, and so forth. The book of Judges, for example, the story begins. Joshua has died, and the question is asked: now that Joshua is dead, what are we going to do? And they start out in Judges 1. United, gung-ho for continuation of military conquest, but by the end of Judges 1, Israel is almost on the ropes. It is a comic introduction to the second segment of the history. In Judges 19 to 21, the last chapters of that book, things have deteriorated to the point where Israel is involved in a civil war. It's the rest of the 12 tribe organization united against the tiny tribe of Benjamin. And the civil war proceeds to the point where Benjamin is almost completely decimated. Only 600 male survivors are left. and after which they are presented in chapter 21, the last chapter of the book, as suddenly realizing that they've almost wiped out to one of their tribes. How is it going to be possible to be Israel anymore if we're not 12 tribes? It's a comic conclusion, a tragic comic, but in any case, clearly comic conclusion to the period. And so they decide, they ask, who is there anybody who didn't come who didn't respond to the muster call to go to war against Benjamin? And he said, yes, there's this place over in Jordan, northern Jordan, Jabesh Gilead. They didn't send anybody. So the elders decide that it will be necessary to have one more unholy war in order to get some lives for these 600 survivors of Benjamin. And so they send an expeditionary force over here into northern Jordan with instructions to wipe out the Jabesh Gilead, to destroy all the males, but to save only the virgins, and to bring them back for these 600 male survivors. Benjamin, well, they do, and it is a successful unholy war, but they come back several hundred short, and so they're once again thrown back upon their own resources. And in chapter 21, they say, yes, there's the annual Yahweh festival up the road here at Shiloh. Tell you what you Benjaminites do. You go up there and lie in wait in the vineyards. And when the daughters of Shiloh come out to dance the dances, why, you each one sally forth and take one for yourself and come on home. And when their fathers or their brothers come to us to complain about this, we'll explain to them that they should give in freely here, because you, the fathers and brothers, didn't give them, and we, the elders, didn't take them to a sheer grace. What we thought up. And the curtain rings down on the era of Judges with a tragicomic retelling of what must, in fact, have been a very costly and very disastrous civil war within the 12 tribe organization. The humor is bitter, but it's there. The pre-monarchy period ends in a situation exactly comparable to what it had been before it began, a period when there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes, that is, on internal ethical control. That's the way it was before we were a nation state. That's the way it's going to have to be now in the period of the exile. I didn't mean to get off on that long digression about the tragicomic framework of the book of Judges. But you get some idea of what they were doing in the Judges. They were letting the story stand, warts and all, but retelling the beginning and the end to set the whole period in a tragicomic framework. We're back where we started from. A people united, but without a land. Maybe that's the way it's supposed to be. The people of Yahweh. Okay. Back to the book of Joshua, they didn't do it that way. They retold the stories in a highly stylized way so as to present Joshua and Israel and their performance as exemplary. Except in chapter 7. And it took one-fourth of the book just to get us to Jericho. We're going to take two more whole chapters. We'll be one-third of the way through the book before we've had a second victory. And all of the stories in chapters 1 to 9, incidentally, are concentrated in the territory of the little tribe of Benjamin. here we are, we left these three scholars. They've been sitting there all week since last week, pondering the ruins of ancient Jericho that you see here, and asking themselves, where is Gilgal, and possibly out here. We need the overhead light on here still for a minute. The stories in the first nine chapters all take place in the tribe of Benjamin. This tiny little area right here. Nine of 24 chapters. Here's Jericho down here. Gilgal, somewhere near the oasis. The next battle will be at Ai, which is a day's march up the hills, atop the watershed ridge, but just barely. And in chapter 9, the target will be the city of Gibeon over here. Does this mean that stories that originally had to do only with the territory of Benjamin were selected out as, in some sense, example stories, and in the process of telling and retelling, became the story of all Israel? Are these stories in the early chapters of Joshua etiologies? Is that term clear to everybody? Everybody know what an etiology is? If I go to the doctor with an ailment of some kind, I sincerely hope that the doctor will be able to recognize the etiology of my condition. It's a good term in medical practice. The explanation. And many of these stories in Joshua and Judges are often taken to be simply or properly described as etiological stories, stories which were told in order to explain a phenomenon or to explain a name. We talked last week about the possibility, at least, that the story of conquest of Jericho in Joshua 6 may be originally an etiology to explain why there was in Israelite possession a ruin where the periodic or annual reenactment, religious celebration, liturgical reenactment of the conquest would take place. I resisted that interpretation because that story does not have the clear marks of an etiological interest that other stories do, especially the ones that are coming up now in chapters 7 and 8. So, I think that the thing to do is to move next to those stories. But the question which I'm continually interested in as a historian and as a biblical scholar is the relationship between the stories and the question of historical memory. And we'll get into some of the dimensions of that as we move along. First of all, I better say a few things about the handout before we carry on the lives. Ignore the text to the left for the moment. That's a page out of Commentary on Joshua by my favorite writer. We'll come back to that later. In the middle of the upper part of the page, we have something called a map of the Bukeya Valley. And you see the Dead Sea down in the lower right-hand corner. The Bukeya Valley is just up above the limestone bluffs, looking down upon the Dead Sea. A narrow valley, about 8 kilometers long and 3 to 4 kilometers wide. three archaeological sites in it, here labeled Kirbet Abu Tabak, Kirbet Es-Somra, Kirbet Al-Makari. This is the valley which is known in the biblical material and in Joshua 7 as the Valley of Achor, which means the Valley of Trouble. Or in my translation of it, I've rendered it Devastation Valley. We'll see some slides of it in a moment. Yes, A-C-H-O-R. The block plan, which you see in the upper right-hand corner, is a drawing of the fortification found at Tel El-Ful, which is almost certainly the ancient town of Gibeah, which was the site of Saul's capital, first king of Israel. This too is in Benjamin. It's a few miles north of Jerusalem. What you see here is the plan of a fortress from the 12th and 11th centuries BC. The black portion at the lower left-hand corner represents what was actually excavated. The rest of it is a projection. This was an excavation carried out by W.F. Albright, and later resumed by Paul Lapp. And Lapp called into question the actual projection of the remainder of the the building, especially the northern end, if I remember right. But in any case, this is the remains of a rather small fortress on a rather small site from the period with which we are dealing. And we'll say more about that later. Down the lower left-hand corner, we have a drawing of the impression of a couple of scarabs of Pharaoh Thutmose III. The reason they are included here is that in both of them you see the deity, the god, on the right, holding aloft a weapon, which was a bronze sword, the curved sword, which is often referred to, therefore, as a sickle sword. It has the shape of a sickle, and it was a heavy, hefty instrument. The edges were blunt. You didn't cut with it, you bludgeoned with it. A sickle sword. You see the god in both examples of this. You see the god holding the sickle sword aloft, and then to the left, you see the king, Thutmose III. And so, who was the Everybody thought the incarnation of the deity. You see him holding a subject by the topknot and wielding the sickle sword in his other hand. This is a scene which you see again and again and again in Egyptian art, not only on the scarabs like this, but on the pylons of the great temples at Karnak, even Pavlov, Thebes. Repeatedly. And the sickle sword has acquired a symbolism, which we'll talk about a little later on. This was a weapon which was in use throughout the Bronze Age. It was used as a weapon. And during a millennium or so of usage, it acquired also a very a high symbolic significance in representative art, because here the sickle sword symbolizes the identity of the interests, the identity of the power of the god and the king who rules in the name of the god. So they're one, the deity holds aloft the symbol of sovereignty, while the king wields the symbol of sovereignty against an enemy or one of the subject peoples. Well, we'll come back to the significance of these things as we move along. Now, let's go to the story in Joshua 7. Now, this is the first thing that happens after Jericho, after the cursing of Jericho at the end of chapter 6. And we read that the people of Israel committed a treacherous violation of the ban. Achan, son of Carmi, son of Zabdi, son of Zerah. Achan, ben Carmi, ben Zabdi, ben Zerah of the tribe of Judah had taken some of the devoted goods. We're not told where this happened. Nowhere in the story are we told where it happened. An editor has picked up a story about an ancient violation of the ban, of the Haran decree, which almost certainly, we can now say, originally had to do with efforts at controlling pestilential disease. It was a matter of attempt at plague control. Has taken one story about a violation of such a decree and has referred it to, or related it to, the story which precedes in the finished form now, the story of Jericho. And we're told that the B'nai Israel committed this treacherous violation of the ban, although only one man did it, Achan. And Yahweh's wrath was kindled against the B'nai Israel. So Joshua sent some men to the ruin. That's to Ha'ai in Hebrew, which means literally the ruin. So the place already had its name before the story begins. In this case, there's a clear interest in the meaning of that name. In chapter 8, the name of the ruin will occur 22 or 23 times in something like 25 or 26 verses. So the people who gave us chapter 7 and 8 are clearly very interested in that name. Joshua sent some men to the ruin, which is near Beth Aven, that is to the east of Bethel. And he said to them, go up and bury all the people there, where they are few in number, 2,000 or 3,000 from Jericho. How large were towns in the ancient in this period? A recent article in one of the most recent issues of the Bulletin of the American Schools of Oriental Research, a very interesting study of the distribution of towns, cities, and villages in the Middle Bronze and Late Bronze Age periods. Five categories. Category number one, tiny towns, maybe 2.5 acres. The village which we will be seeing at Ha'ai, which was in existence in the Iron Age, was just about 2.5 acres. Small towns were maybe 2.5 to 12.5 acres. Jericho, throughout most of its history, was no larger than this, except possibly in the Neolithic period. It was possibly larger, but not by much. So Jericho, although it is an impressive appearing town, was a small town. Medium-sized towns, maybe 12.5 to 25 acres. Ha'ai, if the ruin at Tel, near Deir Dagon, is the site, and I think it's almost bound to be. In the early Bronze Age, it had been, it was even larger than that. It was 27.5 acres. It was a large city, had been, Ha'ai had been, throughout the early Bronze Age. But toward the end of the Early Bronze Age, the whole town was violently destroyed, and it was not re-inhabited by a sedentary population until late in the 13th or early in the 12th century. Joseph Calabay, whose excavations have done a lot to clarify the situation, dates the establishment of the earliest Iron Age village there to possibly 1220 BC, but no earlier than that. So the Iron Age village, which bears in the Bible the name The Ruin, was built in the midst of large-scale rubble and large-scale walls, as we shall see, which had been in ruins for about 1,000 years before the biblical story in this part of the country began. Don't send up 2,000 or 3,000. I think that's the Hebrew word aleph, which we talked about last time. Usually translated 1,000, because it very often does have that meaning. It's the number of 1,000, but it's also the word we now can be quite sure for the muster unit, the draft quota for the village or the clan. Anywhere from 5 to 12 or 13 men in the lists that we have in Numbers 1 and 26. So I think that what they said was, do not deploy all the people for about 2 or 3 contingents. 2 or 3 units can go up and defeat the ruin. Do not weary all the people there, where they are few in number. So there went up thither from the people exactly 3 contingents. But they ran away in defeat before the men of the ruin. The men of the ruin struck down 36 of their men, and the people's heart melted, turned to water. In other words, on the older translations, they sent up 3,000, suffered a loss of 36, and considered that a resounding defeat. I think they must have sent up 2 or 3 units, totaling perhaps not much more than 40. Or 50, out of which a loss of 36 wouldn't be disastrous. With attention to these sorts of things, the significance of the meager Iron One ruins at Ai, the potential significance of that, or the possibility of some kind of historical memory being preserved here, and not merely an etiological interest in explaining the name of the ruin begins to suggest itself to us. So Joshua rent his clothes, fell face down on the ground before the Ark of Yahweh, and stayed that way until evening, and he said, Lord Yahweh, why did you persist in bringing this people over to Jordan? And the answer he gets from God is, well, there's been a violation of the harem. You got to find out who was responsible. And so, long drawn out process of using the lot to isolate the perpetrator. They bring him out and his family, everything that belongs to him, and all his possessions, and they burn him. If it was a matter of a violation of a harem decree, which had to do with contaminating persons or things, then persons who had handled them would be subject to ban also. But the interesting thing is, you see, this story about Achan's violation of the harem is inserted at this point in such a way as to do two things. First of all, I should read the conclusion to it. Joshua says, in fact, to this young man, or this man, when they find out who he is, Oh, Joshua said, why have you devastated us? Yahweh will devastate you this very day. And this is the punchline. And so the waters will stone him. They burned them and stoned them. They erected over him a stone cairn. Then Yahweh relented from his hot wrath. Then comes the ideological punchline. Therefore, the name of that place is called Devastation Valley, Valley of Achor, down to this day. So here is an ideological story. It explains the name of that little valley, which on your handout is the Lukea. But it also does something else. It diverts responsibility, attention away from General Joshua and his responsibility for a serious miscalculation and therefore a disastrous military defeat. So, it doesn't happen twice in the book of Joshua. Everywhere before this and everywhere after this, they proceed only at Yahweh's command. And in the next story, which tells about the victory at the ruin, Yahweh takes direct command. He tells him where to place the troops and so forth. So it didn't happen twice, not while General Joshua was in command. The interesting thing about the story of the victory, however, is that it comes apart in two pieces, as indicated on the handout in that first column. What I'm going to do is read the segments here that are listed under the column DTR1 on that handout. And we will have omitting, in other words, omitting verses 3 to 11 and omitting verses 20 to 25. And we will have a story complete in itself. You can omit verses 3 to 11 and verses 20 to 25. Read everything else and you have a continuous story. Yahweh said to Joshua, be not afraid or dismayed. Take with you all the fighting force and go back up to the ruin. Attention, I have given into your power the king of the ruin with his people, his city, and his land. You shall do to the ruin and its king as you did to Jericho and its king, except that its booty and cattle you may plunder for yourselves. Place an ambush against the city to its rear. He had taken exactly five contingents, stationed them in ambush between Bethel and the ruin west of the city. Thus they stationed the people, the main camp, which was north of the city, and its rear guard west of the city. Joshua went out that night into the valley. When the king of the ruin saw it, the townsmen hastily made preparations and went forth to confront Israel for the battle. He and all his people were at the assigned place facing the Arabah. He did not know that there was an ambush against him to the rear of the city. We'll see something of the geography of this in a moment, but the two important towns involved are Ai and Bethel. And they're separated by a little valley. Bethel is to the west of Ai. And Ai is right at the brink of the descent into the Jordan Valley. When the king of the ruin saw it, the townsmen hastily made preparations and went forth to confront Israel for the battle. He and all his people were at the assigned place facing the Arabah. He did not know that there was an ambush against him to the rear of the city. Joshua and all Israel let themselves be routed before them, in other words, feigned a retreat, fled toward the wilderness, that's the descent into the Arabah. All the people in the ruin were called out to pursue them. They pursued Joshua and maneuvered away from the city. There was not a man left in the ruin or even the sanctuary who did not go out after Israel. They left the city wide open and pursued Israel. Yahweh said to Joshua, point the Hebrew kidon, a Hebrew word here, which is a rare word used very infrequently, but Goliath had one, one of the few places. You usually translate javelin in the old translations. point the kidon, the javelin, in your hand toward the ruin, for I am giving it into your power. So Joshua pointed the kidon in his hand toward the city. The ambush arose swiftly from its position and ran while he stretched out his hand. They entered the city and captured it, and they swiftly set fire to the city. Skipping over the next section. Joshua did not withdraw his hand with which he pointed the kidon until all the inhabitants of the ruin had been executed under the ban. The men of Israel plundered for themselves only the cattle and the spoils of that city in accordance with Yahweh's word, with which Yahweh had commanded them. Joshua burned the ruin, made it an everlasting tale of devastation to this very day. The king of the ruin he hanged on a tree until evening. At sunset, Joshua gave the command, and they took his corpse down from the tree and threw it down at the city gate. They erected over him a stone cairn to this very day. What's that kidon doing in the story? There, if you know the topography, there is no way in which one man holding aloft a weapon amidst troops fleeing downhill to the east of Ai could have been visible to people in an ambush behind the city of Ai in the little valley there between Ai and Bethel. Well, a few years back, Dutch scholar Othmar Kael published a study of representative art in the ancient Near East, for which ancient Israel, because of that commandment about graven images and so forth, had no counterpart. And he was looking for correspondences between representative art in the world around Israel and narrative art in the Bible, and suggested, made a very, to my mind, convincing argument that rare word kidon was Israel's word for the sickle sword, which had been a standard piece of military equipment throughout the Bronze Age, but which went out of use. To judge from the results of excavations now of over a century, went out of use in the Iron Age. But while it was in use, it attained high significance as a symbol of the exercise of sovereignty on behalf of the deity. So Carroll suggested that we have a story here, a story about how the victory at Ai only took place when Joshua functioned in such a way as to signal that this was Yahweh's victory, not Israel's. And so I've translated here, hold up the sickle sword that is in your hand. It's a chancy translation, but I think it's more interesting than Java. And I hedge my bets in the comment on the subject. But that's DTR1. You see, that's a story which serves to legitimate the king's use of symbolism that also belongs to deity. That's the first edition, the pro-Josiah, the pro-monarchy edition. Somebody, however, has broken that open and has inserted these verses 3-11 and 20-25, in which we have long drawn out repetition and confusion in what is going on that makes this a strict counterpart for the defeat of Gibeah in Judges 20. In that civil war at the end of the period. In other words, the final editor, our friend DTR2, has taken the first edition, broken it open, and turned that into an ironic preview of the way matters finally came fell out in Judges 20 in that tragic civil war, which really resulted in the total obliteration of one of the tribes. Therefore, turning it into a story that might indeed be supportive of life after monarchy, whereas the first edition was told to be supportive of life during monarchy. Well, some examples of the archaeology before we put and throw it open to questions. We don't really need this. Maybe it will be helpful to look at it for a moment. Oh, fine, thank you. Jericho here at the southern end of the valley. The bouquet, these three dots are the three sites in the little bouquet map on your handout. The first black dot in the mountains here, this that element in the story of a forced march under cover of darkness is possible. Just a few kilometers to the west of that, the site of Beitin, almost certainly Bethel. Those are Gibeah, just a few, well, it's the northern suburb really now of Jerusalem down here. Flying south along the western side of the rift, the Jericho oasis out here to your left. This is the higher limestone massif. Now, if I can get my bearings, the Bukea is right in here, just before you make the descent out of the higher mountains onto the Morley Terrace at the site of Qumran and the famous Francisco Caves is situated. This is the site of Cubit Mird, which towers above the bouquet. You can see just the northern part of the descent into the Bouquet Valley here. This is the Dead Sea. We're sitting right over here at the present time. There's the Bukea, a narrow valley, explored back in 1954 by Frank Cross and G.T. Millick during a season of excavations at the site of the Dead Sea Scroll discoveries at Kirby Qumran. And they were concerned to plot and do soundings at a number of at the three ruins which are part of, indicated on the little sketch map there, which had previously been known but never carefully studied. And their excavation results were later turned over to Lawrence Steger, who did his Harvard dissertation on the subject of desert farming in these areas. These turn out to be these three ruins turn out to be the remains of ancient farming settlements, which flourished for one period only. There is no evidence in the excavation or in the survey of the area of any sedentary population in here prior to the establishment of these three fortified settlements, somewhere in Iron II. Well along in the period of the monarchy, therefore. So They consisted of large rectangular fortified areas. They made extensive use of broad, low dams to slow down the runoff of the winter rains, because they had discovered that if they could do that, the soil was such that it would retain the moisture long enough to produce a good crop, at least very good crop. These are settlements which were interpreted, therefore, as, and they correspond, these three sites do, to three places that need names in precisely this part of the country in the list of the towns of Judah that belong to Judah in Joshua 15. So that means that the map of the tribal settlement, which we were looking at a moment ago, which is based on the description of the tribal plains in the latter half of the book of Joshua, that map is a reflection, and the last half of Joshua is a reflection of the claims that were being made during the period of monarchy, anachronistically, in part at least, projected back into the pre-monarchy period, because there was no settled population here. It was the Devastation Valley. Yes.
I just got lost.
How'd you get lost?
There are these three places.
Mm-hmm.
Stager has evidence only for occupation in late Iron II.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Late Iron II, they're looking back.
Well, and since these places had names in Joshua 15, that means that the list in Joshua 15, in its present form, cannot be earlier than late monarchy.
Right, it comes from Josiah, probably.
Yes, right.
Correct. I'm with you on that.
Mm-hmm.
How do we know these are the three places?
I say they correspond. There are no other places that fit the description. In one of these 12 provinces of Judah that are described in Joshua 15. I've had to go back in the commentary because this may be the result of a late revision of the tribal list.
Okay, and all across when he was excavating, it was one period of occupation.
It's a one period, and Stager and I went back there for a couple of weeks in 1975 also.
And Dan's losing the farm.
Yes. So they're very likely paramilitary settlements that were established by one of the late Judean kings.
Give me a size.
Possibly. Pardon?
Could you give me a size on one of those? Are we talking about rectangles 25 feet?
Sure.
Meters?
Yeah. What now? 68 by 40 meters.
68 by 40?
Mm-hmm. Outer walls, about a meter thick, inner walls, something over half a meter.
Larry's
dissertation, but he has he has articles, and he did the piece, no, I guess Cross did the piece on the bouquet in the encyclopedia, which I have a and Stager has a major book on the subject, forthcoming soon, on the subject of desert farming. This is a... I thought I could see the line of one of them. Well, I showed this because here's Kirbit Mir looking back from the opposite side. The previous slide was... I'm sorry. There we are. They were looking west from this point down into the Pukea. Here, we're back looking across the Pukea at Kirbit Mir up here in the distance. Good right angle view of the terrain. This is the line of one of the dams. It's on the meter stick on one of the sluice gates. This is another view of, I think it's the same dam. And incidentally, this is in Judah, and not in Benjamin. Everything else in, which is curious, everything else in Judges 1, Joshua 1 and 9 takes place in Benjamin. This is the site of Dere Dibon, or the town of Dere Dibon, and a house at the edge of Et Tel, which in Arabic, of course, means the ruin, which is the most likely candidate for the site of Ha'ai, which in Hebrew means the ruin. Of course, there are a number of places named Et Tel on both sides of the river, but other candidates for Ha'ai have been suggested by one scholar or another, and they have been checked out, and nothing earlier than Roman remains to be found. And so I think that this is, I would agree with Callaway that this is most likely Ha'ai.
Zion. How do you spell that?
Just A-I. I'm sorry, in Hebrew, in the Hebrew Bible, it is always written with the definite article, ha. Ha-I, V-I, the ruin. But it's often simply transliterated as I. First name. Now, this is a view from the mound, looking down the major access wadi, leading directly down to the Jordan Valley. This was a massive city from early in the EB. A few statistics. A major, well-planned city from about 3000 BC, the last phase of EB1, according to Callaway. A well-planned walled city. It was a class 4 city, a large one. You're looking down on a portion of the excavated city wall. Piece of the wall, with a large rectangular building dominating the Acropolis, and very plausibly interpreted because of the positioning of pillars within it and artifacts within it as a sanctuary. Went through a number of periods of decline and rebuilding, resettlement, abandonment, and resettlement throughout EB1, EB2, and EB3, with subphases in each case, except for the first. But was violently and totally destroyed late in the early Bronze Age, about 2400 BC, after which there was no sedentary occupation. Callaway is now convinced, after a number of seasons of very, very meticulous work, no sedentary occupation until late in the 13th century, perhaps as early as 1220 BC. There emerges here, as there emerges on many, many hilltops now in the vicinity, a small, unwalled village. And this one was no more than 2.5 acres in size. Tiny little place. Nestled amidst a large proportion of rubble. of a great city of the Great Billings, period. Is the story, oh, and having characteristic really iron